Welcome to the Fargo Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Fargo on FX. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about season 4, episode 3, titled Redoppiarlo. I don't know how to say this. It's an Italian word that essentially means double it or a doubling of something. Double.
Yeah, pour it on. Whatever trouble you got, make it double.
Sure. Team double Rocket. Down on all your mistakes, everything like that.
Yeah. What'd you think of this episode? I turned it around on you.
I enjoyed it. I don't know how this season of Fargo is coalescing for me. It's not... like I mentioned in the first two episodes, it's a little different in tone than some of the other seasons of Fargo. Not necessarily in a bad way. It's just I haven't quite settled into this season yet. And I think like some of the acting is maybe throwing me off a little bit. But I don't know. There are still a couple of really good scenes in this episode that I thoroughly enjoyed. Dr. Senator continues to impress me. And the other really good scene is the attempted assassination scene. What do you think of it?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying about the tone. I mean, I watched Fargo, and a lot of times I'm kind of like, oh boy, I wonder where they're going with this, or like I get really gripped up into a scene, and then, you know, something ridiculous happens, and I always ask myself, like, am I cool with that? And almost always I am, and I find that I worry that the show kind of goes off the rails sometimes, but then I don't know. It goes off in the rails in a very smart, calculated way. I put on something on Twitter along the lines of, is Fargo trying to like wrest the smartest, stupid show title from Rick and Morty? Because you have this show that's full of largely cartoon characters, but they're saying and doing some really interesting things, and then they have fart attacks, and they got vomit and shit coming out of both ends of their system, and...
yeah.
You know, Timothy Oliphant will do a 3-minute sermon on Mormonism, and it's all very compelling and well done, and like the thing is like the characters and the settings are sometimes outlandish, but they never act that way from within it, you know, like just because we're in the middle of this high stakes robbery where someone got shotgunned across the room and we're now farting and throwing up everywhere, the scene doesn't turn into slapstick.
Right.
It's just a funny thing that's happening. Like if that actually happened to Swanee and Zalmare, I think that's how it would happen. You know, it's not like all of a sudden they're slipping and falling their ass. And so it does work for me. And I also think they're trying to, and I think Holly does an okay job. They're trying to do this thing where they're telling stories from different perspectives, you know, like, Loy Cannon is putting forth an argument about some form of black conservatism in this episode, which you don't see represented a lot. And I thought it was a pretty well-written scene, but there's a couple of notes that rung false to me as a former conservative. But maybe we can get into that. But overall, I think that this show is doing a lot of interesting heavy lifting, and it's also entertaining as hell too.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing else on TV like this show, so I don't want to be, you know, too harsh on it when it maybe doesn't hit the perfect tone because it's trying things that are so far removed from the norm that occasionally it's not going to hit the perfect tone. And I think more often than not, it does. So I'm willing to forgive when it doesn't. But yeah, I'm still just trying to settle into what it's doing this season. That's a little bit different.
Like, you know, Noah Hawley made a decision early in Fargo, or not Fargo, Legion, this show he made about X-Men mutants and telepathy and psychic battles to, like, represent battles on the astral plane as, like, dance battles. And if that instinct had gone wrong, then the show just doesn't fucking work, right?
Sure,
but he made that instinct to pay off, and you're exactly right. Like, I'll forgive a lot of people trying to do weird shit. And some of it's going to fail. Some of it's not always going to stick. But like I admire that refusal to kind of play it safe, because there is a Coen Fargo formula that you could hew to very carefully, and you know, most people would be very happy, but you wouldn't get the crosswalking fart assassination of with a BB gun last episode, and it's worth a few belly flops to get those moments out of the show, at least in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I want to start moving into a structured discussion of the episode by talking about, you know, we left last episode just waiting to get some Timothy Oliphant, U.S. Marshal 50s action. And we got a whole big dose in this episode as he's... presence as U.S. Marshal Dick Deffy Whitquare is comes into focus. I mean, is it a problem that Timothy Oliphant apparently is so strictly typecast now? Because I don't have a problem at all. Like when he comes in with his long, lanky Raylan Givens walk, which is every bit as distinctive as Tom Cruise's run. And he, his first essential introduction to us and his character is him mugging in front of the camera and slowly putting a cowboy hat on his head and, getting it just so. That's kind of what I'm here for. I would be upset if he played it a Minnesota cop or something, you know?
Yeah. No, that's what you hire Timothy Oliphant for at this point. Although he's done other work. I've seen him in things like Santa Clarita Diet, where it's just pure comedy. He's playing a very different character. I kind of enjoyed that show. Though, man, it's a silly show. But yeah, he's done other stuff, but this is why you want Timothy Olyphant. You want him because he's the guy from Deadwood. You want him because he's the guy from Justified. Like, putting him in this U.S. Marshal position, you know, with the big hat, with everything, is perfect. It's perfect.
You know, usually he plays, I think, and you're right, this is essentially Timothy Olyphant's kind of character for several things that he's played. And I know he can do other things, but but he does do this. He does it really well. It's like, you know, Mike Ehrmantraut, Jonathan Banks can do a lot of things too, but he does that dead-eyed mackerel stare, and that's kind of what you want him for.
Sure.
It's interesting that he's playing someone that is pretty reactionary and what we would call by 2020 standards bad. You know, like he's got a lot of racist views. He's got a lot of very socially conservative views, no doubt. You know, he's just like, I don't know how much appetite there is for a strictly law and order, no shades of gray, no discretion kind of lawman in 2020. But so he's not like, you know, Raylan, it's always fun to see him being this verbally playful, you know, uncompromising hard ass, because he's always, you know, usually fighting the good fight. Same thing with Seth Bullock, you know, like he was always punching up, right? It will be interesting to see him kind of play something of a heel with within this likable, charming character, because he is still very likable and charming.
Oh yeah. I like what they're doing with the imagery of him, you know, going around sniffing sheets and sniffing lipstick, and they're making him into the bloodhound, even when they have bloodhounds, like literally bloodhounds in the back of the shot sniffing around. He doesn't need them.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting. What did you think of his the fact that they're hanging a lot of things on his religious belief as a Mormon elder?
See, I don't know much about everything. I know about Mormons comes from the Book of Mormon, which is you know, the South Park guys, yeah, doing a stage play. So I know very little about Mormonism. I don't know how it could possibly affect his outcome in this show.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of my best friends is a Mormon cop, actually, and one of my other best friends' wives is an ex-Mormon. So I've gotten, you know, like I've seen that, and I also, as a, you know, former Jehovah's Witness, I know that they had, I had some kind of like felt like we were like distant second cousins, because, you know, if you ever saw clean-cut young men walking down the street in pairs, it's a good bet they're either Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
If they're wearing short sleeve shirts with like, you know, more plain solid ties, probably more Mormon. But yeah, we actually have a former Mormon that wrote into the show to kind of clue us in on some of this background material. It's a real fact that, like, yeah, there's a book on the Missouri state law that you could shoot Mormons on sight. That's a real thing that they were talking about in this episode. It didn't get repealed. Okay, when do you think this thing got repealed?
2 weeks ago. I don't know.
yeah, they got it. The Missouri state legislator got an advanced screener copy, and they're like, we can worry about COVID, the economy. You know what? We got to get this off the books.
Right.
We can't have Mormons not moving into Missouri. So 1975 is when they finally, it was put on in like 1830 during this intense border war going on between the Mormon settlers and I guess the other folks of Missouri. It's all interesting stuff. And throwing him in with the other oddball cop, what is a Wef? Detective Wef is also an interesting choice, because they picked this Deffy guy as like incorruptible. You know, he's working for what I would call as a corrupt institution in a corrupt age. But like, you know, from the system's perspective, he's like an untouchable, upright, moral character, doesn't drink, doesn't even have caffeine. And we know that Wef is bent as a coat hanger.
Yeah.
Where do you think that's going?
I mean, they got to pit him against each other at some point. I don't know quite yet. It also kind of paints Wef as a guy who is not 100% dedicated to his job either. So it's not even just that he's bent, but also he doesn't seem as good at his job as dedicated to it as Deffy is. Because, you know, there's a scene where they're searching for the outlaws, the fugitives in the basement, in the mortuary, and they're opening drawers and they get to the last drawer, the second to last drawer, they open it up. There's a disgusting rotted body in there and they all just run from the room, right? They don't check the last drawer, which
the last one, right?
I have to think the bloodhound would have sniffed out that drawer almost immediately.
That's true. And I wonder if there'll be fallout when he realizes that, you know, Wef whiffed on that. Wef got a whiff and then whiffed on the case.
He sure did.
But I think it's interesting too, because, yeah, like, I don't know, because Wef, he's got this thing where he says the, you know, 21st century opinion of kind of like, hey, you know, everyone that's not this dark, it's not like everyone who's a shade darker than the Norseman's got sin in their hearts. Mm-hmm. But he is actually a corrupt cop working for a mafia gangster.
Yeah.
And we got an incorruptible cop that's kind of racist working on the other side of the case. I think it's interesting the tension they're putting between those two characters. Mm-hmm. Also, what do you make of... it's kind of entertaining, but Timothy Oliphant's character, Deffy, got that name because he just doesn't hear shit he doesn't want to. Like, every
and
time...
in this episode, yeah, it's weird.
Every time Wef tries to, like, get a rise out of him, like, you know, challenge him to step out, he's like, pardon? And then, you know, like, go fuck your aunt and uncle. How's that? Like... I wonder what's going to happen when he comes up against a person who's just not going to stop telling, you know, who's not going to be intimidated by that. Like, how far will he pull that? Or is, like, that's his first move. His second move is Raylan Givens' micro flash drawing of a gun and putting up someone with
right.
a bullet point in their O and their, yeah, the O ring.
I could see a scene between him and Gaetano being pretty entertaining. In that regard.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Cause
yeah,
he,
you got crazy eyes versus Deffy.
Uh-huh.
The man with the incredible know. Sight versus the man with ears that can't hear. Who will win? The man with the eyes that see everything versus the man whose ears who see nothing or hear nothing.
I think he's like keeping a tally, right? He's like he hears these things, obviously. He's not...
Sure.
He's not deaf in the literal sense. Like...
Sure.
I can't help but think he's got this running tally of people who have insulted him, said things to him they didn't want to hear, tucking things away, and then telling people, like, oh, I didn't... you know, making people think he didn't hear things that he did hear. That's a smokescreen, I think, of some kind.
Yeah, I think I'm thinking this might be a three-step tango. Like, step one is, pardon me, come again, how is that? Please. Step two is, I'm trying not to hear that, see? Step three is, kapow, you know?
Yeah. I'm
looking forward to, you know, and no one's ever pushed him past that first step in this episode anyway. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was really spooky the way they set up the, like, more grade. And having this this Wef guy who's just a, you know, a bundle of nerves, he's got this one little, two little, like three little Indian deal. That's going to be a doozy of a revelation, right? Like whatever war story that they're going to flashback to tell us how he got that particular tick is going to be some kind of fucking deal. Or yeah. I don't know, maybe he just has OCD and he got it, you know, there's like not much to it.
Definitely has that. But was it caused by something? Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see.
How does this guy lead raids? Like, could he even do a no-knock raid?
No, he tries to like sneak into this mortuary, right? This morgue or whatever they got. And he's there flipping the lights four times. And I mean, if you needed a warning that the cops were coming, this guy's your man.
Maybe that's his problem. That Fadas thought he was working for them because every time he was going to do a raid on their facilities, he always had to turn the lights on and off. Like, and they got out the back door, and it's like, hey,
yeah,
Paisano, you're working for us now. But yeah, the rotted corpse is disgusting, and it also just shows something about Swanee and Zalmera, that they're pretty rough and tumble, mm-hmm. you know. Like, that made three strong men flee the room throwing up, and they're, like, right underneath that thing. Although, I guess I thought those things would be kind of hermetically sealed. Like, you wouldn't think that, like, the one below would be smelling terrible, but they got lucky, yeah. I guess.
No, it doesn't look like it. you know, there are any rubber gaskets or anything, you know, no seals on those drawers. But I imagine in real life there would have to be, right?
Plus, it's supposed to be, it's got to be refrigerated too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
So I would think that would, although, you know, having something going bad in the fridge is, it's not like being, making it cold, unless it's frozen, it's still going to be pretty, pretty bad. But they also, Deffy corners, Ethel Rita's mom and her family, and you know he's got her. I saw as soon as they sit down, they got five place mats, and there's only three people there. Like, do you think that they ran Dickie Deffy, Weefy, whatever, Wickware? Do you think they ran him off? Did he buy all that shit that they were saying? Or
no, I don't think so. He just knew he wasn't getting anywhere. But maybe I'm reading too much into that. I don't know who this guy is yet. I can't just like say, oh, this is Raylan Givens, right? And Raylan knows when he needs to back off and give them time to make a mistake, something like that. I don't know who this guy is, but that was my read on it.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely, I don't know, she laid on the Jesus Christ stuff pretty thick, which I think he is, maybe that's his weak point. But also just the way they played it, where he held their gaze like intensely for like 5, 6, 7 heartbeats, and then just instantly, okay, well, sorry, you know, have a great evening, I'll talk to you guys later. It doesn't seem like he bought it. But also, if he comes back, they're going to be gone. Do you think that, I guess that's the other question, is Swanee and Zelmer, after they do this ill-fated raid on the cannons, are they going to come right back to their sister's house, or are they going to have a stash of their own?
God, I hope they don't go back there, because you know she's saying how much danger they're putting them in, and I agree, I don't really want them in that house.
But that's one of the like lesser known Coen brothers films, Lady Killers, with Tom Hanks like as this weird off-putting Colonel Sanders type who's got a gang of like bank robbers, and they are taking refuge within this woman's house without her knowledge. I think she thinks they're a group of musicians or something, so I'm wondering if they're, is this going to be a constant consternation? These people coming in and out of the house and attracting all the wrong. I mean, that keeps up, you're going to have all kinds of attention, not just legitimate law enforcement, but you're going to have FATA and canon enforcers after you, I think.
Yep.
But yeah, I also talked about Amber Midthunder, the character who played or the actor who played one of the Carrie Loudermilks from Legion, being Swanee Cap, and I was wrong. Apparently she was cast in this role, and I guess Uza Aduba was Crazy Eyes from Orange is the New Black was cast to play Zalmer, but somehow that got changed late in the process. And a lot of the official sources and like wikis and stuff were still listing her as playing the character, but it got switched to Kelsey as Billy, who has been in the show Wild River and Yellowstone. Because this episode, I'm like, there's no fucking way this is Amber Midthunder. She's wearing prosthetics or something, because like it's close, but no way is exactly. And several people emailed me. The first one is Eddie. A guy by the name of Eddie let me know that I got that wrong. So sorry, but like I did the research. It's just a lot of these sites still hadn't updated the real character's name. So
yeah.
I want, because like when you look at these characters, you can see that original casting, it's like, oh, they were looking for a particular type of character in person to play this. I wonder what went wrong that they switched from fairly established, recognized faces that had worked with Holly. Well, in one case, it worked with Holly before, to these other people.
A lot of time it's just scheduling.
Yeah, especially if this had to all gone down before the shutdown, because imagine if they had their... You know, you're not gonna reshoot all that shit just because someone can't go back for a week's worth of shooting, right?
Right.
Damn.
Right.
Anyway, so that's kind of it with the Timothy Oliphant stuff this week. Do you want to talk about shit that went on with the Cannon Gang?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of Dr. Senator Esquire.
Damn.
He's everything. He's the trifecta.
That's a name that marches in and takes charge.
Absolutely. So we didn't know he was a lawyer before this, did we?
I think they mentioned that he had a doctorate in economics and law, but I know law? He had a doctorate okay. in something, but yeah. The Esquire yeah. was a bit of a surprise, yes.
It surprised me, but this story he tells and the scene he has in the diner with one of the Italian guys, I think is, he might be one of the best actors on this show.
Damn, yeah.
He fits right into that role, and that the story he tells, you know, about going to Nuremberg for the trials and interrogating this dude for years, I don't know, however long it was, taking his report back to his CO and him throwing it in the trash. That's all, you know, in service of demonstrating that essentially, like, you get the respect you can take, I think is what he's trying to say there. You got to fight for everything you get. And the whatever deals there are always subject to change. And so, you know, they find themselves sort of pitted against the Italian mob here by saying, no, we're not backing down on the slaughterhouse. Yeah, we know that this whole thing with the old Don is just a farce. It was never real. But it doesn't matter. We've taken them. We want them. They're ours now. And I mean, it's setting up a huge amount of tension to come. Like, you know, Gaetano already tries to act on it. And I don't know what Justo is going to do. But this is probably the most interesting part of it to me, of the entire story, like more than, you know, what's going on with catching the fugitives or any of that stuff. It's this canon Fata rivalry.
Yeah. The actual mafia shit. I agree. This scene was amazing. And this guy, Glenn Turman, the thing that I most recognize him for is he plays the corrupt Mayor Royce of Baltimore in The Wire that the Mayor Carcetti okay. eventually takes over from. But this guy is so good. This scene where he's like talking about, it's like this one long, like 4 minute monologue take, just staring right into his eyeballs. It's really good. It's really good because, like, it really sells this whole, like, you know, he goes in that V, the double V for victory, that you're striking a blow for your country, but you're also striking a blow for your fellow black man, and there's going to be no more lynchings and blackjacks at the polls. And,
yeah,
you know, I checked my history books and things didn't get better after 1945 for African Americans, it turns out. I thought that stuff was great. And the fact that, like, the okie doke that keeps happening, like, you know, he thinks this is it. Like, I've been called for my skills and my education and my training to take this Nazi down, make this case for the people. And he does a beautiful job. And it all gets thrown in the trash, like, and just for a power play between two white dudes, you know?
Yeah. Using his race as a vector of humiliation for the other guy. It's yeah.
And it just, I think these scenes, like, doing a really good job of showing, like, you know, that shell game that is whiteness, because, you know, Dr. Senator is speaking to this Fata Consigliere, like, he is an establishment white, part of the white race, which, you know, give him a couple years, give him a few dozen years, he'll get there. But, you know, if you'd ask that guy whether he's white, probably he would say no.
Yeah.
It's, and you just keep going back secession layers, like Irish, you know, Jewish, like the layers of white, of assimilated whiteness, mm-hmm. that some people can't attain. It's a great scene, and a great performance. And like you said, because now, like, to the canons, like, now that they got this, why would they stop? Do they just want that little taste, or are they going to keep pushing?
And there's no reason to stop.
And you know, we'll get into what's going on in the Fata gang here in a bit, but, what did you make of the scene where Loy Cannon's going into his stronghold and he's accosted by a guy who's kind of like down in his luck? They imply that he might be on drugs and whatnot. What did you make of that scene?
I'm not 100% sure what to make of it. I see that scene and I start to think, like, oh, is this like pointing out some kind of a sense of entitlement? Is this you know, trying to like create a class division, like what is going on here? I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah. I think that like Holly's trying to do like I mentioned in the preamble of the show, he's trying to advance an argument for like some kind of black conservatism, you know, and I think the only thing that rang false to me, because like it's funny watching this scene as kind of like from my political vantage point now, I'm a lot closer to Loy's son's point of view than I am to Loy. But like what I thought was false is when he took the money roll out and the guy's eyes glazed over, like he was literally, I felt like that was overplaying the scene. Like he should have played it like the guy's like, oh man, maybe Loy's actually going to give, he's like this super generous guy and look how much money he's got. Maybe he is going to change my life. And then Loy can kind of like, he could be like, oh man, I can't believe you're going to, and then Loy can fuck with him. But just having him go over it like it was a, he's like a, some kind of slavering dog, I thought was bizarre. It's like, okay, that's, you know, Aaron Sorkin, like that's like the type of conservative scene Aaron Sorkin, where he just can't help himself by making it utterly dismissive and dehumanizing instead of just like, you know, survive, kind of like, you know, essentially a lot of conservative points come down to survival of the fittest. Like, oh yeah, it would be nice to be able to take care of everybody, but unfortunately in the real world we have limited amounts of resources and funds, and if we did that then everybody would be poor and broke and dying, and we'd have no law and we have no order and everything would be chaos. And it's that versus like, well, okay. And then, you know, I think a thinking person listens to both of those approaches and decides, well, I don't know, how much money do we have, how much wealth do we have? But like I said, I thought it was so close to being good. And it also is an interesting starting point for the relationship he has with his oldest son and himself. What's his oldest son name? Lemuel, something like that.
That sounds
right. I'm
trying
to get these characters' names down. Yeah.
Eventually, like episode 7, I'll get him. Sure. So they, you know, when you point it out that way, it sort of seems like it's of a piece with what Dr. Senator is saying, right? It's about the, you know, for Dr. Senator, it's about the respect and the deal you can force, the respect you can take. And here it's the financial component of that, right? It's about the money that you earn, not the money that's given to you.
Yeah. And I think that's, you're right, because that's another okie doke. I think a lot of people are, the deal was, if you stay in school, you work hard, you keep your nose clean, you should get ahead in America.
Yeah.
But for far too many people, especially young people, that has turned out to be kind of a joke, that like there is an infinite amount of work you can make. It doesn't matter whether you're doing something grossly illegal or immoral. It doesn't matter if you do all the right things, you can still get fucked if you get sick, or if you're born in the wrong neighborhood,
or if you're
born
black,
you get caught up with the wrong people.
Right?
Sure.
Like,
sure.
These are the people who feel this the most intensely.
Yeah. And then you've got an example of, like, you know, Loy Cannon, one of the guys who's starting to escape this gravitational force. And now, you know, he's a big believer of the American dream. And this guy in the streets, just a bum who's wanting to see himself as making a future for himself versus and getting a handout versus, you know, like, I don't know, is maybe a problem is like we don't do a good job of offering the actual American dream to enough people, or making sure that they have the skills and resources available to get that no matter what start they have.
Sure.
You know, like it's Loy Cannon's epic, like, you know, monologue against this guy, this bum, versus the bum walking around saying that ain't right. This guy's got a pocket full of cash, I got nothing, what the fuck. That's going to be interesting tension between him and his family.
Yeah, for sure. Let me ask you, how are you feeling about Chris Rock 3 episodes in? Because I'm looking at this scene and I'm going, God, I just watched, you know, like a year ago, maybe American Gangster. Where Denzel is playing this kind of guy-ish, you know, he's maybe a little, you know, he's cranked up to 11.
It's 20 years down the line from Loy Cannon, right. So he's got a little bit more,
But I can't help but think, man, I want Denzel in this role. Like, I want someone of that caliber. I want someone of Dr. Senator's caliber, as far as, you know, acting goes, in this role. And it almost requires it to get these points across to make me feel the weight of them. And I'm not quite sure that Chris Rock is bringing, you know, that perfect performance that I need from this.
See, I think, again, I see what you're saying, and I was thinking the same thing. Like, is Chris Rock nailing this? And I think he like is brought in for scenes like this because there's this moment where you're not really sure what he's getting up to, and he kind of gives you like this Chris Rock almost on stage, but like look at the performance I'm about to give. Like, look, I'm about to blow this guy's wig back.
Sure.
Where to me it's really working, and it also really works when he's talking like one on one to Dr. Senator about like consigliere shit. Mm-hmm. But I can definitely see your.
It's like a 9 out of 10, right? It's like almost there. And for a guy who is known as a stand-up comedian, this is really good performance. Like, I'm watching Seinfeld with my wife over the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. Jerry Seinfeld doesn't get into a role like this. Jerry Seinfeld couldn't pull off anything even close to this. Chris Rock is doing a great job for a stand-up comedian, but he's not. He's not a top tier A-list actor like a Denzel.
Well, you know, I'm thinking like, is this an intentional juxtaposition with Jason Schwartzman? Because you can say the same thing about him.
And I do, yeah.
Like, here's the thing. Like, I think these guys both have to do something psychotic, or they have to make me believe that they have some kind of force of personality that would cause rough men to follow them and not just push over their popsicle stand and take all their money, right?
Sure.
Now, you know, Josto, he's got the much tougher fight along that front in this season, but like, yeah, I get what you're saying, and it might be that this is an intentional juxtaposition, that these guys are not exactly cut out to be these figures. And I don't know, I have this working theory that like maybe the lesson at the end of this is going to be moderates working together in harmony rather than hard asses running roughshod. Like, there might be some kind of like blended harmony that would lead to a guy like Mike Milligan down the line rather than like all out continued cycles of warfare, which is an optimistic take for 2020. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. It's one that we need though. Like I can't remember where I said this, but I think it was in the Boys podcast where I was talking about like, I hope they're going to make this congresswoman be a genuine, like, true blue, good congresswoman, because God damn it, we need some good examples of that in media.
Right.
You need a little bit of unity in your media to encourage unity amongst the populace. And maybe that's where they're going. I don't know.
Neither one of them are the type that's going to go to the mattresses and, you know, die screaming, holding a razor blade to each other's throat. It's like there is signs that they are kind of like businesslike about it. And there might be some kind of way to peacefully coexist or merge. Like, isn't that how all the big.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're trying to do, like, with Rabbi, right? Like,
we talked about this with the banking concerns, like how like the little banks that refuse to play these, like they eventually get steamrolled and bought. Like, maybe this is a merger of the FATA canon concern into some, you know, like new Kansas City mafia that survives. That's kind of like my long term theory for how the show is going to go. And that would suit having two essentially people who are more noted for making us laugh than making us shit our pants. But I also wouldn't surprise me if, like, I think Chris Rock is capable of pulling a scary performance out of him, and it would be even more effective. Like, you know, when Elijah Woods plays that psychopath in, like, Sin City, right? It's super fucking creepy to see Elijah Woods as a cannibal, because you think of him as Frodo. He's the sweet kid from North and from Deep Impact and whatnot, like... You know, seeing those elfin features employed for psychopathy is uniquely creepy. I think he could maybe pull that off.
Yeah, he needs that one big scene that's really going to push him over the edge for me.
I thought the scene with Dr. Senator where they're talking about tornadoes, like, I thought that was really good. You know, he has this thing where he appropriately deals with this managerial instincts of this young gun Leon, his organization, and then he's like, "You think this is the right play?" Oh yeah, it's like, well, you know, God gave us tornadoes to teach us kind of humility before chaos. And went in and said, yeah, no, that's right. But then again, you can raise the odds. I thought that was a really cool scene for him.
Yeah. Do they go anywhere with that? Does he just say you can raise the odds? And then that's the last we see of him this episode.
No, because they have the closing consigliere scene where they're trying to process the simultaneous hit on his son and the The Numbers House.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you want to, we can talk about, I was going to go over to the Swanee Zalmare, stuff, because they're like doing a lot of comic relief in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I like that like tent scene outside Nick's safe house, and it kind of scrolls over to the pans over to them, and they're talking like 10 inside versus 5 out. You know what that means? Yeah, we're gonna have to reload. Like,
uh-huh.
It's such a great scene of bravado. I thought, these two women are very, very likable.
Sure.
And they've got that kind of like comic intensity, but also they're, you know, I have to cut you in half with a shotgun if you give him any lip. So, mm-hmm.
I just kept waiting, like this whole pie thing, that's going on throughout this episode. You know, it's ironic in a way. Like, there are so many guns in this scene, and Chekhov's working on the pie level.
Yeah.
As opposed to the guns, I don't know.
It's Betty Crock in it.
I kept waiting for it to hit, and like it sort of like, I don't know, slow rolled it a little bit. Like, you've mm-hmm. got her with some intense stomach problems, and when they were in the trunk face to face, I'm thinking, oh no, this Epicac's about to kick in, and it's gonna get real bad real fast.
Oh, I was waiting for like the mouth to mouth kiss vomit. Like,
yep.
I was not prepared. I was preparing myself for what was about to happen. Yeah.
I think I was almost over prepared for what was about to happen. I was the things that were coming to my head were so much worse than what actually ended up happening that I was slightly let down by the chaos that erupted in the heist scene, although I thoroughly enjoyed that scene. It's just it had maybe given me a little too much time to spin a fiction in my own head.
Yeah, they're doing some interesting work there too. Like, there's two prominent kissy faces being made, one to guy from Gaetano to Josto, and the other from Zalmare. She blows kissy faces at this one of Loy's men. I wonder if there's some kind of connection being made there between these are the agents of chaos. You've got the two organizations that could actually merge their families. You could see it happening. But you got these agents of chaos on each respective side that is going to make that very hard. And interestingly enough, the two agents of chaos working at cross purposes looks like orchestration from the outside, which I thought was a really, really tight piece of plotting.
Yeah, I love how all that comes together. The way that, you know, it looks one way, but it could be another way, and the leveler heads prevail in this scenario, right? They're gonna feel around for a while before they just go off and react. That stuff is really good. The construction of the plot here is really good.
I do. And I just love the scene of like Swanee like leaning up against the door, the building, like labored breathing, like belching and farting, and she's no, I can go. Ugh. And then having to go. Oh my god. It's like I said, it's a very funny scene, but in the universe, no one's laughing because these women still have guns held on them. They still have kitchen knives. Well, that's another commonality that they're drawing between Gaetano and the Swanee Zalmare gang, is these prominent kitchen knives. You know, like Gaetano's always got that like fucking 12-inch chef knife on his belt.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
And Swanee pinches one from Ethel Rita's family's kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like I said, I don't know what. Maybe it's just the agents of chaos versus the agents of order that they're setting up.
Sure,
that's always a nice pairing too, right? That's how the tension that makes the movie Casino work. That's the tension that makes like
Jurassic
Stringer
Park
Bell.
Work.
Well, or yeah, or like in The Wire, Stringer Bell versus God damn it, I bet the Barksdale. Organization, you know, like one is always talking about having a name out in the streets, and one's always talking about going legit. Like, having that stuff set up in these two families, I think is going to pay off narrative dividends.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk about, like I said, we're right here at the end of the, because the other thing that happens is Gaetano. Can I ask you this? I did not get from the first two episodes that this Gaetano guy was deranged.
Yeah, he's pretty seriously deranged.
He was a tough guy, but like the stuff he was like, he's a clearly a very tough guy in contrast to his brother.
Yeah,
but like he is full on bug eyed crazy.
I mean, it sounds like he grew up like he was literally raised by wolves. Like he grew up in the woods after his village burned over in the old world.
Right.
He views, you know, fighting as the only purpose in life.
Yeah, they're warriors, these fadas. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was picking up a little hint of like crazy. He was doing some weird stuff with his eyes in the first couple of episodes where it was maybe inappropriate, which tells me, okay, this guy's a little off his rocker, but this is a whole new level.
It's almost too much. Like, I haven't quite figured out where I set on it, but there's something about this guy who I don't know if I take him fully seriously.
I mean, the same is true of Josto, actually. Both of these guys are so silly in their own ways that it makes me look at the guy, I don't even know his name, but the guy who's sitting with Dr. Senator at the table in the diner, and going, what, why, how do you get like such lunatics and weirdos in the top ranks here when you got a guy like that who could be more level headed, who could sit there and actually run this organization with even a tiniest bit of sense?
Yeah. Because even Josta, it's like, I want to say he's the level headed guy, but he's more concerned with like taking out this Harvard guy than, you know, watching what the cannons are doing, keep holding them accountable. It's very bizarre. This guy, it's like Joe Pesci walks this line effortlessly. Like Joe Pesci's not a very physically impressive guy. He's got this weird, you know, he's got this weird, like high pitched kind of reedy way of talking. He's a funny guy, but he also can be fucking terrifying because he's like that crazy person who just doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, and this guy is giving me Joe Pesci energy, but I just don't know if he's got that top gear. And I don't know. There's tons of feedback about, hey, you got to see this guy in Gomorrah. It's this Italian, a real Italian mafia shit. And
I plan on watching.
So I'm not saying I'm not saying he doesn't have that gear. It's just like, you know, three episodes in, this guy's eyes are lolling in his head like some kind of fucking demented jack-o'-lantern. And he's just this pudgy dude like sloshing from scene to scene. Like what the hell? Do you know what he's drinking, by the way? That like, is that absinthe?
No, I think it's limoncello. It's a very Italian kind of aperitif sort of drink. Yeah. Alexis and I were talking about that in that scene. We were like, is he drinking limoncello? He's got to be.
Like, it's these elaborate glasses. I figured it was some kind of like thing. Yeah. Is it very alcoholic?
Fairly, you have to,
like, drink pitchers. Okay. No. Like he's drinking it like it's water. Holy shit.
Yeah.
And they're setting up that battle within the family, which I think is interesting in terms of Rabbi Milligan. You know, when there's questions about whether he's loyal to the family, I mean, I think he's pretty loyal to the family. He's keeping the family. He's like really serving the family's best interest and not just being a yes man, which is also something that kind of like ties in thematically to Deffy versus Wef. You know, he's saying like, yeah, I'm not saying that I won't do this. I'm just saying like, this seems like a bum play. And like, who did his order come from? And like, who was her actual boss? And
yeah, I mean, Rabbi is probably the best character they've got going in this show, because he's that amalgamation. Yeah. He is like when he says, you know, he's not Irish, he's American. That couldn't be more true, right? He's the mutt. He's the mix of everything that is American. He's what, an Irish kid who was raised Jewish and then traded to the Italians. Like, it's all of those things mixed up in one. That's what America is. And if we can't figure that shit out and understand that, yeah, we're all just a bunch of mix of a whole bunch of things. Let's just all get over our individual hangups on that stuff and work together.
I'm telling you, man. What if I'm wrong? Is Josto and Gaetano both have to go, and Rabbi Milligan takes over the family and merges with the cannons, and that's how? Yeah,
I could see it.
Because you're right, he is the Michael Corleone in this family. He's like two families cuckooed away from it, but like he is the Michael Corleone. Yeah. You've got, oh my God, the Fadas. Yes, the Fadas. You've got Santino.
Okay,
you know, yep. The bull, the
hothead. Yep,
you got the hotheads, good fighter, but it's got no goddamn common sense. And you got Fredo, who is just, as far as I can tell, useless. He's just the like one-off factory defect, and the true fucking steel, Michael Corleone, is Rabbi Milligan.
Yeah.
I don't. And they even draw conspicuous things to like names and what does it even mean? Because like you know, Loy's got this other really nice monologue about his boy trying to cite proxy war, Cold War theory at him, and he's like, no. These other boys have their own names. Your last name's Cannon. That means you're me. I wonder if they're trying to say something there about, like I said, if I'm right in this theory, this is all going to look like really great foreshadowing, which I don't know. I feel like makes the theory look pretty good.
Sure.
And that's the other thing I felt like, because you've got these warring, you've got the Loy Cannons, you know, self-made man. Go out and get your own thing, hustle versus, you know, got your hand out, stealing someone else's money, blah, 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 versus that ain't right. And you've got, you know, this other line by Lemuel, whether you can't have both mores, you know, you can't be more safe, more power. You can have less power, more safe. You can have more power, less safe. Did I get that right? But you can't ever maximize both those quantities. I thought that was an amazing point.
Yeah.
You know, the more power you get, the more people are going to try to come gunning for you. Where if you share power, you have less power. It's you know, perhaps more democratic. That's spreading that stuff around is the safest for everybody.
And that was pretty good too. I mean, it's true of almost everything. It's probably true of literally everything in the universe. You know, like if you're a gamer, if you're a nerdy gamer and you play RPGs, you should understand this, right? The concept of min-maxing. You only have so many points to go around, either, you know, and in terms of like what we were talking about earlier with the money and, you know, how that affects our society and how some people have everything, some people have nothing. This is a zero sum game in almost every regard. You're never going to get to any kind of reasonable situation unless you can find a balance between the two extremes, and that's true of goddamn everything in life.
And I just like, I think that this is, you know, you mentioned the scene at the end being like just a real pleasure to see these guys are having, they got good information, they gotta have accurate information, but they're drawing the wrong conclusions from it.
Yeah.
And then them, like Dr. Senator, kind of slowing things down and being like, well, what if this is Night of the Long Knives? Which, if you know, that was like the mid-30s purge that Hitler made of like consolidating all his power in Germany. You know, he had these like paramilitary brown shirts running around doing violence in his name. And it's like, we need to bring this a little bit more in control. This could be actually a rival organization. So he ganks all. This could be the brother consolidating his power and like, you know, starting some shit and, you know, trying to eliminate his rivals at the same time. And it is a tricky situation because they've got his boy Satchel. You know, they're maybe vulnerable because they're, you know, I'm sure it's a little bit of a reach for their organization to try to take over the stockyards. It's a really interesting political situation, and I love like Dr. Senator's breaking that down. It's like, hey, you know, if we're going to start shooting, you know, if you're going to start roughing up Josto's boy, we got to really be sure, because if not, you know, we're plunging our families in the war for nothing.
Yeah. And I do wonder what the next step is here, because obviously Rabbi, you know, shut down this hit on the kid.
How's that going to play out? Jesus.
Is he going to go to Josto and tell him? Probably. I assume he will. How does that, you know, fall out between Josto and Gaetano? It's all, you know, stuff that I'm interested to see in future episodes.
Why are they so abusive of the rabbi? I thought this bad behavior was just because, you know, they hated black people and they were like intentionally being like neglectful towards Satchel, but it seems like the Rabbi Milligan is like the lowest man in the totem pole, which is why he got stuck with, you know, because yes, of course they're all racist towards Satchel, but he kind of gets that responsibility because of his low status. I felt like when he said when he's talking things over to Satchel and they're talking about playing the hand you gave and like being traded amongst teams, and he says my team is shite. Is which team is he talking about? His old team, the old team, or the current team? Because they all look like shite to me from his perspective.
Yeah. My guess is he's talking about what the Irish, which he's actually an Irish kid who grew up Jewish and then was traded over to the Italians.
Shot his Irish dad, betrayed his to the Italians. But like, I'm not sure why. Because I thought when we heard Rabbi Milligan, heard he's Irish, that he was going to be kind of like a Tom Hagen type from The Godfather. Mm-hmm. You know, the adopted Irish son who's essentially Italian in everything but name only.
Right.
I'm honestly shocked that he's being like seen as this less than character. Which I think has a little bit of Miller's Crossing in it too.
I haven't seen that.
This season seems like it's such a great blend of so many different Fargo concepts and also being self-referential to itself. Mm-hmm. Like now Fargo's got four seasons of mythos that it can start, you know, throwing in aces and things, little things up its sleeve that it can use for inspiration.
Yeah, one of those things is Nurse Orietta Mayflower. We haven't talked about her in this episode yet. She goes over, which is kind of what I expected. She goes over to the hospital where Dr. Harvard is the administrator and gets a job there. And then has this bizarre hand job scene with Josto out in the parking lot where she's singing the battle hymn of the Republic to him while she's jerking him. It's weird, man. It's hilarious and weird, and I loved it.
Fellas, if this ever happens to you, get out of the car. Yeah. Run. This is not a meet cute. this lady is fucking crazy.
Totally crazy.
Man.
But she's so, like the Lorne Malva, speaking of like references back to previous seasons. She's that other agent of chaos, right? The almost malevolent agent of chaos,
unstoppable force of quasi supernatural evil.
She's embedding herself in higher places. I don't know where this goes, but it's enjoyable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about in these scenes. Number one, Dr. Harvard, who is the hospital administrator, I'm pretty sure they're going to reveal that that's not his real name. Like, this is going to be a literal Dr. Senator. Like, he was some German, son of a German immigrant or whatever current wave of xenophobia he was on the previous way. His name's not fucking Harvard. No fucking way. Like, this is an internet guarantee lock that they're going to reveal that he was some kind of Dutch, Irish, German, you know, Grant, his daddy was barefoot and alcoholic or some kind of shit, and that he's playing the same deal that Dr. Senator's trying to play a little bit more successfully because he's white.
Sure.
But they also make this point of like, you know, like how easy it is for people in these trusted positions, and you can think of like priests, doctors, nurses, cops, how easy it is for them to go from place to place with just kind of like, You know the job, you know the lingo, and you say the right things, and they're overstaffed, and it's kind of like whenever you can get into the circle of trust, that you're, you know, pardon the expression, aces, and here she is, she's gonna, you know, old boy, she's gonna get to start killing again. But then you see Josto spying on Harvard, and when she just jumps in.
He's sitting in the parking lot making finger guns up at the window, which I don't know. I just imagine myself a bystander walking past his car, looking at him, looking at the window, going, what the hell is he doing?
What's happening? She loads up his nose, gives him this rapid fire. The Battle of the Republic, a lot of people don't know this, but it's actually was written as an anti-slavery marching song for the Union Army. Like, it's literally about stamping out the evil of slavery, and, you know, everybody just knows the first couple bars to it.
Yeah.
But I think that is another level of irony here, that you've got this woman they've broadly established as, you know, a pretty baseline 1950s racist, you know, given this dude who's also both the target of racial discrimination himself and the perpetuator of this rapid fire handy to an abolitionist's rah-rah song. It's like,
yeah,
the irony runs really fucking deep.
And this whole scene is a whirlwind, right? Like, he doesn't even know who she is in this scene. She's just like, I don't, this strange woman who enters his car, gives him coke, jerks him off, and leaves.
It feels very similar to, like, Lorne Malvo's relationship with Morgan Freeman's character in the season one, where it's like, you know,
Martin Freeman, yeah.
Morgan, yeah. Uh-huh. I would like to see Morgan Freeman playing that character,
yeah,
with the Minnesota accent and everything. But yeah, no, the way they kind of blew in and out of each other's lives, and like every time it got slightly worse. Mm-hmm. I wonder though, because like, okay, we talked about this last two episodes. I'm starting to think that he didn't really authorize that hit against his father.
I wondered that when it happened. I was like, was he just talking? And she's picking up on the wrong thing,
right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the fact that he didn't remember meeting her two other times because of the drugs and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. I don't know. It seems pretty crazy. And the fact that this is set up to happen again, because every time he asks her, like, well, what's your name or number? She's like, haha, you silly person.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when she finds, I mean, what happens when she finds out that not only does he not know her, but like doesn't know all the things he like, that's going to be a tense scene.
Yeah.
Especially if there's a little bit of like, you fucking killed my father added to it. I don't know.
He might get a pie in the mail.
The only thing I guess we got left to talk about is there's this really good scene with Swanee where she's talking about what haunts people, what gets haunted. It's not houses. It's not things. It's individual people. And it's a pretty spooky scene. Like, it shows Ethelreatha's mom, like, you know, like listening to her talk secondhand about her family being cursed. I guess, first of all, let's talk about that. Ethelreatha's family's cursed.
Apparently.
What do you think about that?
I don't really know what to make of it. It's a claim that they make. We'll see if that's true, I guess.
It seems like Swanee is, you think she's taking a pro or anti position that, like, well, like if houses can't be cursed and it would stand and only people can, only individuals can, then the idea that you'd have a family curse is nonsensical. That it's, you know, you're as cursed as you want to be, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose she could be saying that.
But I don't know. It's also interesting. Swanee, like another individual melting pot, or mom apparently. Some sort of Plains Indian, or father, a Chinaman who worked on the railroads, stitching this country together.
See, can we
famously the target of a lot of racism themselves, the Chinese West Coast immigrants.
Yep. Here's the thing. I got to admit, I was so focused on this fucking pie during this scene that she's chowing down on. I only caught the barest essentials of what she was even saying and what the scene was about.
Well, so. It's also like a lot of nonsense, like this. Or so everything she says got more and more improbable. And they also preamble it with like, oh, we're just telling tales here. But she talks about her father being a Chinaman who then could hear whispers on the breeze and then eventually lived in a cave with a coyote. And then the coyotes start howling in the background of the scene.
Okay.
Which, Fargo as fuck. But she said that like her daddy had two shadows, one for himself, one for the devil. And then at night, and here's where it gets weird, like at night he would hug me too tight. And I'm not sure if this is, you know, another addendum to her, like, you know, trying to rape the Indian out of me versus just saying that her father was so traumatized that he held his family so tight that it like was painful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not like you could read almost anything into that.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see. But like for some reason, her and Zelmer don't seem like they're touched by this curse, even though like they're just very lighthearted and, you know, matter of fact about it. They don't appear to be haunted at all, but
yeah.
I don't know. Can a non-haunted woman smoke an entire cigarette in one pull?
I think so.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
All right, Jim, I think that's going to about wrap it up for our thoughts on Fargo this week. But we got a bunch of people sent in feedback to fargo@baldmove.com. Speaking of a lot, Jim, we got a lot of feedback about one thing. Do you remember what we said immediately after hitting stopping record on last week's podcast?
No.
We said, damn it, we didn't mention the captive bolt guns in the stockyard takeover scene.
Yeah.
How that's a No Country for Old Men reference. Which it was a great scene, too. Like, I loved how every single time one of those went off and you heard the cow drop, everyone jumped and, like, drew their guns at each other. But, yeah, in 4 hours of Fargo to cover, we left that one off. And a lot of people told us that we missed it.
I thought I briefly mentioned the sound effects in that scene. And I might have mentioned that it was a thing, but definitely I didn't mention that it was from No Country.
Yeah, but yeah. So yeah. David was the first guy to send that in, and we thought about turning it on and like just shoehorning it in somewhere. And it's like, you know what? Let's get the people contributing here. So thanks for keeping us on the straight and narrow captive bolt. I do believe someone's going to be killed by the hands of those captive bolt guns before the season's over, though.
Absolutely. I mean, you've got a battle over the slaughterhouses. There's no way that doesn't come into play.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking. Eddie says, I for sure can't wait to see more of Timothy Oliphant, and I also really enjoy how Rabbi Milligan isn't just some random person. His character is interesting. It seems to me that Milligan is willing to betray his family because he has shown much more respect from the Italians than he did from his own family. I wonder if he takes Satchel and shows him how much more respect than Cannon does, and Satchel betrays him and fully joins with Milligan, changing his name to Mike Milligan. I think that's an interesting theory, and I do think there's going to be some kind of unification here, as they've suggested. But I don't see why Satchel would betray Loy. Like, Loy seems like he's always trying to done right. But on the other hand, his oldest son is being estranged from him. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really calculate that into my factorings of who's going to win the gang war. But
I was trying to think, like, oh, does Rabbi show him that much more respect than Loy does? I don't know. We haven't really seen Loy too much with Satchel. But based on, you know, what we see with him and Lemuel, you could maybe see the, like, okay, it's not about necessarily the lack of respect there. It's more about, like, directing his life and pushing him in a direction, and maybe one that, you know, Satchel doesn't want to go in. Maybe he wants to be more like Lemuel. I don't know. We got to see more about it.
I mean, from what I can see, like, Loy definitely loves his kids, but it might be more of a tough love, like, more of, you know, this is how the real world works, kids, you know, kind of stiffness to it. I don't know. But then again, what is Zero, I guess, Josto's kid, what's he getting? Like,
we have no idea, really. There is that one scene when they're about to trade, right? And he... You know, he's trying to, like, it seems like he's giving him some decent advice. I don't know.
But it's that same kind of Machiavellian, you know, realpolitik, kind of, like, hard-boiled, where I know it's Josto, like, with a little kid like that, maybe he's a little bit more loving.
For the world they're living in.
But he's treating him like his son, for better or worse.
Absolutely.
Whereas Satchel's just getting fucked over at the Fada place. You know, he's getting the Rabbi Milligan deal, which is... not a good deal.
No.
Not in line with the contributions he's putting into the family. Let's put it that way.
And I get the impression that Rabbi at least had his own room until Satchel moved in. You know, he was quarantined. He was relegated to the attic space. But he at least had his own room. Now he doesn't even have that.
Now he's bunking. Yeah, he's bunking with this kid, which he doesn't seem to mind. Like, there's this, like, scene where he's like, hey, if I don't come back, I'm either dead or in jail. Mind your studies, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They're also playing this what is the utility of playing Marco Polo in a room where you both see each other and not...
I don't know. That was so weird to me.
I tried poking around to see if there's some kind of, like, 50s fad or some kind of joke or something about, like... But, yeah, I don't know. I don't get it.
I don't either.
I will say the kid playing Satchel is, like, impossibly cute. Like, the way his eyes go, like, dinner plate wide when fucking Gaetano is carving up the scene and eating it is really, I love seeing. Epic Mouthful has the next feedback, probably stating the obvious regarding a significance to Oretta's last name. This is Nurse Mayflower we're talking about. In a season where his major theme appears to be immigration, racism, and Americanization, the name Mayflower may well be a nod to the theme. Of course, Mayflower, we all know, it's the boat that took the pilgrims across, landed on Plymouth Rock. Or perhaps more than a nod, especially since she's essentially been this season's quote-unquote angel of death. As Indigenous Peoples Day approaches, I can't help but think of one of the more famous Malcolm X quotes from the film, "We didn't land on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock landed on us." Makes me really look forward to the havoc Nurse Mayflower is going to wreak this season. Yeah, we talked about Swanee and Zelmer, and we talked about Gaetano, but yeah, Nurse Mayflower, she's a real, real agent of chaos.
Yeah, I don't know where they're going with her. But we'll see.
Is she going to be the ace up Josto's sleeve? Is she going to be the one that can kill Gaetano because he just doesn't see her as a threat?
Maybe.
She scalpels him.
I don't know. I'm trying to, like, see what getting into Dr. Harvard's hospital gains anybody other than just giving her a job.
He won't let the Italians in.
Right. And he's certainly not going to let the blacks in. So... the fuck, like, where does that intersect with anybody else in this show? And I don't think we've seen the leads in yet, so I couldn't tell you.
It's his way of killing. It's the easy answer. It's his way of killing Dr. Harvard, because he wants her to make macaroons anyway. She could poison the macaroons. She can also, I bet that limoncello is pretty bitter, pretty sour. I bet it could hide some strong medicine.
It's actually very, very sweet. surprisingly.
Is it?
Yeah.
But still, so you could put a lot of like, you could grind up an aspirin.
Oh yeah.
Per se.
Probably. And
you wouldn't be able to, yeah, like you could grind some bitter, fast acting medicinal shit and it would completely mask the flavor.
Yeah.
It's interesting that this guy's showing just swilling a lot of this Italian Mountain Dew.
Yes, that's essentially what it is.
that might be another thing where she can fit in her skill set.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be, I don't know. I don't think she, well,
but like, I don't care about this, that is the problem.
No?
I don't give a shit, really? If they kill Dr. Harvard. No, like,
but Gaetano,
that's the trouble, right? It doesn't intersect with any other plot. I don't care about Justo getting his revenge on the guy who turned them away. That's not super compelling to me.
It is the script. So, but it's okay. So you got all these, like, I feel like these systems of checks and balances on the show and the plot, because like, if he continues to put the screws to Harvard, it's going to increase law enforcement focus on him. That's already too focused. Like, Weff, Detective Weff said last episode, just fucking leave this Dr. Harvard guy alone and I can probably fix it. Unbeknownst to Justo, Weff is being brought off that case so he can no longer fix it. And also Justo's going full-fledged into his revenge scheme. So it's like, that will apply heat to other elements of the plot I think you do care about. But it is very...
If they can make a connection between the nurse and him, but I he can't even make that fucking connection, right? Like, he doesn't even know who she is. How are the cops going to...
But it would be interesting for him. Well, that's... Yeah, I guess that would be the ultimate cat's paw. You're right. Because why would they jump to the nurse being a tool of the mafia? I don't know.
Yeah, I really don't know. Maybe they could connect her somehow, you know, back to Donatello. And then just get some ideas. I don't know. We haven't seen, like, how smart is the U.S. Marshal yet. How smart is Deffy? How effective is Weff going to be at covering tracks? Like, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I want to say he's real smart just because Rayland is. But
right. I'm trying not to lean too much on his other characters.
Yeah, how much are they going to lean? Because, you know, Rayland also wasn't a racist as far as I could tell.
Right.
So, Kevin from NYC. What's up, guys? Super glad to have the show and your podcast back. Well, thanks, Kevin. We are too. You touched on Salvatore Esposito as Gaetano last week, and I feel okay. So this is a direct response to our mocking the man's performance. I feel obligated to toss my two cents into the bald move Fargo fountain about this guy and the Italian series he's known for, Gamora. This show is fucking awesome from top to bottom, and no spoilers, but Esposito, as one of the leads, does a phenomenal job of playing a fun-loving party animal turned ambitious psychopath in a ruthless Italian crime syndicate outside Napoli. Is that how you pronounce it? Napoli?
Mm-hmm.
10 out of 10, high recommend on Gamora, which conveniently enough sounds like it's going to be available on HBO Max this winter. One drawback is having to read subtitles unless you're a true madrelingua pisano like Mr. Jones here.
No.
Excited to continue the Fargo journey with you boys.
As long as they're talking about number of years they've been doing something, I can pick up numbers. I can pick up the word Ani. I can pick up a few things.
If they're ordering food, you probably can hang with that.
Sure, pizza. I got that one.
Asking where the nearest bathroom is. All those things. You wouldn't have to bother reading the subtitles for. But we actually had two or three people make the same recommendation, which I'm going to see how the season goes, and then I might check that out, because I'm always in the mood for like a mafia film and like a real fucking Italian mafia film. I don't think I've ever seen one of those.
Yeah.
A spaghetti mafia film?
Absolutely. You know? It is on my list of things that I need to see now, because I'm curious too. Like, what did the Italians make when they make mafia films?
Yeah, mafia man. It's super authentic. It's got to be, right? It's
not, I would think so.
Chef Boyardee shit that Coppola
Scorsese's putting out there.
Scorsese's pushing
out.
Yeah. Come on, Pizza Hut. Make way. Make way for the real shit. Judah comes in saying, after watching the first two episodes of season 4, I have a prediction about Rabbi Milligan's role in the season. In the beginning of the first episode, each time there's a power shift between the families, young Milligan was instrumental in the overthrow. A piece of dialogue I found interesting is during the exchange of the son, the rabbi tells the Fada boy, be who you need to be, don't forget who you are. which I believe could very well apply to the rabbi, given his past and the emotional nature of his scenes of betrayal. These factors combine with the expectations of the Fadas not keeping their power leads me to believe that the rabbi might inevitably betray the Fadas. I think this would be a great twist for the season, and that it would provide some sort of consistency through the story I'm being told. Any thoughts on this theory? Is it plausible, or am I reaching?
Yeah, I like it. He has been conspicuously involved in every betrayal that we've seen on screen, so let's do it. One more.
Yeah, I think, because I was thinking about merging the families, but maybe that won't work. Maybe it's going to be more of like a one-sided takeover facilitated by Rabbi Milligan.
It's almost not even a twist, right? Like, when the guy who's known for betraying families betrays another family at the end, it's not even a twist. It's just the natural consequence.
He's trying to find she's like LeBron James. He's going around the league trying to find a not shite team that he can take to the finals, you know? Like,
all right. Hey, Michael Jordan didn't do that. Michael Jordan just got on a team and made it the team he wanted.
That's true. Put him on his back and took him to the promised land. Right. But yeah, he's taking his talents. He's going to take his talents to the Cannon family. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see.
I think it's interesting. And I feel like you said, it's almost not even a twist. It's like, is it foreshadowing to show, you know, it's like, oh, I think Littlefinger is going to come up with a scheme here. Like, it's, they subverted that by having him. Oh, actually, no, he got outthought by a teenage girl.
They did. Yeah. So the twist here is going to be Rabbi doesn't betray the family, right? He goes to the mat for him.
Right. Yeah. Satchel outfights him easily.
Uh-huh. Picks up a kitchen knife, takes one right to the heart.
Three kitchen knives. Mm-hmm. My God. We got a three kitchen knife theory going on now. Place your bets at Loy. Like, I do love those scenes of Loy's criminal organization. They're running numbers. They're doing credit card stuff. It's just like money's just rolling in like crazy. Jacob says, this may be a stretch. Is anything a stretch in the Fargo universe, though? I mean, literally a UFO could land in the middle of this thing and it would not be outside the envelope, right? True. I mean, that's one of the infuriating and also fun things about the show, right?
Yeah. A fishnado could definitely come through. They've already name-checked tornadoes.
That's true. That's why God sends us a fishnado, to keep your fucking podcaster humble about what can come out of Fargo. Mm-hmm. Jacob continues, after rewatching the show from the beginning, I love how in season 1, episode 3, Lauren Malvo says, it's a dog-eat-dog world, but in season 4, episode 2, there's an exchange between Cannon and Milligan where Milligan says, I'm teaching him how the world works. It's dog eat dog. And Cannon says, that's not how dogs work. Or that's how dogs work. That's not how men works.
Yeah.
Is it coincidence or genius? Y'all decide. Big fan of the show. Keep it up. Well, thank you.
It's not coincidence. I'm not convinced it's genius. I'm convinced it's, you know, people who are aware of the things they've done in the past, which is nice.
Yeah, no, like I said, Fargo's matured to the point where it's not just pulling from the original Coen brothers canon. It's got its own canon, pardon the pun, Deloy.
Right.
That, you know, like, it's now informing itself. You know, Aces is a callback to season 1, not to any Coen brothers film I can think of. Dog Eat Dog World is not a callback to, you know, Miller's Crossing or The Man Who Wasn't There. It's a callback to another season. But again, you know, just like those, it's always been the case that you didn't have to be aware of the Coen brothers' original source material because I don't want people to accuse me of selling them a false bill of goods. I said you could jump in at season 4. Yes, there are callbacks, just like there's always been callbacks in Fargo to other Coen brothers' films, but it's not like you had to see even the original Fargo to understand. You didn't have to see Miller's Crossing, The Man Who Wasn't There, none of that stuff is required. You might get more out of it and see some of these inside jokes, but you're not going to be struggling to figure out the plot. So,
no.
From a shadowy person known only as S. Hey guys, long-term listener and supporter. Well, thank you. Writing in to talk about Fargo. I forgot how much I miss the show and its world. I think no matter how it ultimately shakes down, my money is going to be on the Cannon side to prosper, though not without a few key setbacks or losses. Based on the scene in the park, Loy, after trying to get Don Fada to see that they aren't different, steals a peanut from Don Fada's bag without him noticing. Huh. If Don Fada appeared to pick up what Loy was really saying, it died with him. The Fada brothers are so divided amongst themselves, while also being intently untrusting of and focused on making sure the Cannons feel appropriately inferior to them, despite being in a deal. The Italians will underestimate and or fuck up royally, as evidenced in the third episode. Well, see, that's the thing. Like, did the Italians underestimate? Like, if Gaetano's hit had gone off, I don't know if that's good for the Fada family, but it's certainly good for Gaetano's leadership of it, because that would commit them to a course that would probably lead to Giusto being frozen out, I'd think.
Yeah. Does Giusto pick up that torch and run with it, I guess? He might not have any choice, right? Like, if the war comes to him, maybe he steps up and leads in that, but...
Yeah, it's like his plan didn't fail. It was thwarted from the inside. It's hard to gauge, like, how effective. Because, you know, usually these kind of reigns of terror, it's like whoever goes to the mattress first and hardest and protects his people more and kills the other guy, they're the ones that win the war. Like, it's... Once it gets to the mattresses, it's a lot of the strategy and logistics kind of go out the window. You know, killers versus killers.
I don't think it's going to go the Italians' way just because of what I know about history. This is the slide of the Italians here. So this show kind of set us up for that in episode one, where it was showing all of the rise and fall of these other organizations. Mm-hmm. So that's expect succession. Another one. This is sort of just the passing of the torch to the Black Mafia.
I'm glad that the funeral home mother and father and daughter didn't eat the pie. It's a very cautious mindset to not eat food that you don't know where or who it came from, and still not eat it when you do. If you just went outside and there's a pie, anonymous pie, on your front porch step, you eat that thing?
Hell no. Absolutely not. I will say, I'm glad the funeral home family, I'm glad the Smutneys did not eat the pie. I am glad someone ate the pie. I would have been extraordinarily disappointed if no one ate that pie.
There's still a lot of pie left. I'm wondering if they eat it, or if the fact that, like, you had someone's mouth on it, because it's not like she carved a piece and ate it. She just was just tucking in that pie like an animal. I wonder if that that particular Chekhov's pie has done firing its last gastrointestinal round.
We'll see.
It's clear that it won't kill you.
Yeah,
like there's speculation about, like, what kind of concentrate, but, like, you know, we got a pretty good idea what it's going to do, which is going to make your gastrointestinal system miserable. They continue the unquestioning acceptance and faithful care that the father showed for the pie, even in the stress of the marshals coming in, and Swanee ate it freely because it was free and tasty. So why question it? I just dig in. Both of these show a lot of insight into these characters, and I bet that the mother threw the pie away since it had been picked over, not sliced. Ah, see, that's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. Although, is Swanee really an idiot? Because, like, I don't know that people announced, like, hey, we just found in a mysterious pie. It's more of, like, that got buried in the police raid, and... Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Swanee's dumb or anything. I think, you know, she ate a pie that she was sitting on the table, like... Here's the thing. Here's the difference. Like, I see a pie that's put on my front porch. I don't eat it. I throw it immediately in the trash. I see a pie sitting out on a friend of the family's countertop, and I have no problem thinking, oh, that's a pie I can eat.
Sure. Yeah. Or you come home and there's a pie on your kitchen table. Like, oh, I didn't know they're cooking today, but shit, there's a pie. I'm gonna
Why not?
I'm with that. Yeah.
I did love the dad just carrying this pie around, like, not dropping it, because
hands
to me,
up, citizen.
As an audience member, like, I want to see this pie go off, right? And every opportunity they gave him to drop the pie on the ground and ruin the pie, so no one can eat it.
Yep.
I'm thinking, please don't drop that pie. They gave me exactly what I wanted in every step along that path.
They did. It's such great. Like, I love the little touches, because I had found myself thinking the same thing. And Noah Hawley's kind of, like, got his hand on my shoulder as he exits every scene. It always goes back to the pie. Like, I know, don't relax there. I haven't forgot about this fucking pie. Let me tell you. I thought that was really cool. I love, we talked about the scene transitions, all the different, like, way they block off stuff and do transitions. I love the one that, like, dissolved into the front of,
the car,
that purple wagon that Rabbi Milligan is rolling around in, which is a beautiful car, by the way.
Yeah,
it's a lot of really those, like, just artistic touches that Holly's known for. even the careful use of color in everyone's dress and grooming and the mm-hmm. backgrounds and the cars, like it just really pops.
Yeah, the one guy who's trying to do the hit this episode has like this red coat that matches his red car.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but see that he's like coordinated top to bottom in his life, not just his wardrobe.
Yeah, that guy looked amazing. Mm-hmm. The cannons called him the skeleton, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
S concludes, between the one in the lighthouse and the two attacks so far in Fargo, is this the year of prestige farts? It might be. I've never seen more prestigious farts all my life, you know?
It's true.
You got this and Blazing Saddles for prestige farts. It's a brave new world we're plumbing. I can't wait to see 2021 informed by the year of the fart. Harris writes in, I love the season so far and don't want to nitpick when it's good, but anyone else think Gaetano Fada is just wrongly cast? Maybe it's because he looks like Farva from Super Troopers, or maybe it's his absurdly big eyes, but I just don't believe his performance as this lion in the jungle badass of all badasses from Italy. Like I said, I'm loving it this season, but this character just isn't working for me because of the actor.
I feel you. Is it the actor or is it the direction or, you know, what is it? Like they want us to believe that he's some kind of, you know, grade A predator here, but also he's a complete goofball. So I don't know. They're going to need a couple of scenes to really impress me with his ferocity.
Yeah.
Because so far all I've seen of him is the goofball.
Yeah, I agree. It's a little tough, but I have faith that this guy can be for this ferocious character. Like, I'm waiting for him. Like, this is Joe Pesci in Home Alone.
Sure.
And you're like, oh, how can that guy, look at, yeah, how can this guy, how can the wet bandit make me shit my pants in a cinematic scene? And then you see Joe Pesci with the kitchen knife going to work on some dude.
Yeah.
Or smashing, crushing some dude's head in a vice or something. And it's like, oh, yes, he's terrifying. So let's see if he's got that gear. Everyone says he does. I would hate to say otherwise. Travis, is it wrong to think if I think that the episodes that Holly didn't direct are better? I know the first two episodes did a lot of heavy lifting, but still, this one felt more well-rounded. I didn't notice a big drop in the directorial quality.
No.
I do think that there is a little bit of a very technical proficiency a little Wes Anderson-y, like in the rigid blocking and shot composition and something. It's not exactly stilted. It just feels very, very kind of rigid and technical. Kubrickian a little bit, if you want to go more of the serious and less of the whimsy. But I don't think that's bad. Like I think Wes Anderson is really good.
Yeah.
And I admire that kind of discipline. When you have it, when it's just not just handy cam and shit like that, like that's The Boys, right? Is there a single fucking shot on a tripod in that show?
Maybe not. I don't know.
Like even when it's just like two guys talking, I feel like there's someone bobbing and weaving in the box with the camera, but, that's not this. Also, I said, thank you for mentioning the dark figure in the middle of the street. I thought I was going crazy because no one online is mentioning it. I'm pretty sure that's Deffy. I'm pretty sure that's the person standing in the middle of the street is Deffy. Like it's very similar to the way they're dressed. It's very hard because they're backlit and the scene is got motion blur over the entire thing because it's a continually panning shot. But that's I don't know why they foreshadowed that, like literally 5 seconds before it happens, but.
Yeah.
Nathan V. This is a pretty lengthy take on, I think, a former Mormon about the accuracy of the Mormonism depicted in the show. So I think it's pretty interesting. Nathan V. says, I love the episode and wanted to write in and give my take on the one part that I actually had experience with, which is Timothy Oliphant's character of Deffy and his Mormonism. I was a Mormon for the first 24 years of my life and found a lot of what Oliphant was saying to be very true, especially to the Mormons of the time. I want to list them out here for anyone that hasn't had a lot of interaction with the Mormon church, hopefully in a neutral way, so as not to offend any of her too much, which I appreciate. One, the Book of Mormon, which Mormons hold to be more correct than the Bible. That's the play? That doesn't seem right. Like, I don't know that that's a...
No, there is such a thing for people. I know you're making a joke, but for people who don't know, there is a literal Book of Mormon.
Yeah, yeah. It's the untold story. Well, he's about to tell us the story. It's indeed an account of a Jewish family who sails to America on a boat in 1600 BCE during the first fall of Jerusalem. The family splits into two tribes, the Nephites and the Lamanites. The latter are cursed with the skin of blackness, which is just literally what Timothy Olyphant says in this episode. The Mormon church disavows this now, but it's definitely still part in their holy book in 2 Nephi chapter 5, verses 20 through 23. Wow. It's chapter and verse.
Yeah, just disavow the parts you don't like of your holy book. Why not?
Yeah, there's a lot in the Bible, both testaments, about slavery and how a slave is supposed to treat their master. And
That's why God put them in there, so that in 2020 we could disavow big chunks of his texts.
Yep. It's the divine plan. Who can question it? Mm-hmm. Mormons at the time wouldn't drink any caffeinated beverage due to the word of wisdom. It's now interpreted as only hot caffeinated drinks such as tea or coffee, and Mormons today can and do drink plenty of soda. Interestingly enough, my Mormon friend would not. He abstained from alcohol and any caffeinated beverage, cold or hot. So, like, I don't know if that's one of those, you know, it's like there's this apocryphal story about I forget when the Pope said you didn't have to eat fish on Friday. Like, it was, and like, there's some kind of conclave, and they asked this, like, devout nun about it. And she's like, "What are you going to do, sister?" And she's like, "Well, I plan on eating meat this next Friday and then never again." Like, like, I want to eat meat once to show that I respect the Pope, but then what if the Pope's wrong? I want to go back to eating fish. So, like, it's like, hey, you know what, God, I'm still rolling with the old rules, because, like, what the fuck? Mm-hmm. That Mormon's a Gen Xer. He's my age, so I don't know. That might be a split. Oliphant mentions that he's a priest and a member of the 70. These are both ranks in the Mormon church. I assume he means high priest, which is a rank required to be a member of the Quorum of 70, which is like a regional leader. A priest is something they make every 16-year-old boy so that they can help with the sacrament or mass of Mormonism. So being a Mormon priest is not as impressive as being one of the 70. One of the most accurate things I found about Oliphant's character getting offended is him getting offended by the use of God and Jesus Christ, taking the Lord's name in vain. To this day, I'm much more worried about accidentally saying, "Oh my God," in front of my parents and dropping the more conventional swear words. The Mormon extermination order that the chief police... or the police chief mentioned was an order given in 1833, making it legal to kill any Mormons in the state of Missouri. It's apparently a long history with wrongs committed by both Mormons and other Missourian settlers that I won't go into here. However, the order was only repealed in 1975, but no Mormons were legally killed after about the 1840s.
Okay.
That must have been some 7 years of Missouri history. Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus, Latter-day Christ. Because of the first point mentioned in Mormons in the 50s were definitely institutionally racist. Yes. That seems probably personally, too, the case for many. I'm not saying anything against individuals at that time, but several Mormon prophets condemned pretty much anyone who wasn't white as having earned their curse of darkness. This justified African-American Mormons being denied many rights of membership of the church and many other injustices, such as the Mormon leader speaking out against the dangers of interracial marriages and the like, which led to Utah being a very undiverse place, both religiously and ethnically, making the story Oliphant tells about running a bunch of Italians out of town seem all the more likely. Highly ironic that Utah got the Jazz basketball team, considering all that history. My two cents is that so far this is one of the most accurate portrayals of a Mormon character from a time period like the 50s. Well, I don't have any expertise in it myself, other than a few friends I have, so I appreciate you dropping the line there. Nathan V. All right, that's it for feedback for this episode. Again, if you'd like to send in more, fargo@baldmove.com, or there's our forums, forums.baldmove.com. There's usually an episode thread about Fargo or the latest episode if you want to discuss it with your fellow fans. But send it in, fargo@baldmove.com, if you'd like to see your words considered for the podcast. That's it for this week of Fargo. I can't wait for the fourth episode. I want to see Gaetano's eyes roll out of his head at this point. And I just really like I how long am I going to wait till Giusto and Gaetano go to blows? Because it seems like they're very they're provoking each other. And I mean, my money's on Gaetano. I don't know how he's going to.
I mean, Giusto doesn't roll around with a kitchen knife strapped to his belt. So
he does not. He seems like a lover, not a fighter. Very much so.
He's going to slow pump some babies into Gaetano, I assume. That's his weapon of choice.
I mean, maybe that's the thing. The political connections are what's going to save him.
Could be.
He's going to just have Gaetano deported. That would be kind of on brand, actually. Of the zeitgeist of the time. Of this time. So, there you go. We'll be back next week. Fargo@baldmove.com. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.